It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
No fear, no fear here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, each and every day from Freedom's Phoenix Farm here in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm really excited to talk to our next guest. Pepe Escobar is a foreign correspondent that's been writing for Asia Times, and he's been doing this, you know, foreign correspondent thing since 85. And reading his articles, we've had some of your stuff on Freedom's Phoenix before, Pepe, but I tell you, to consolidate in not even 1,000 words, every single paragraph just references all the stuff that we've known or suspected and puts it into one article. And it's like, boom, slap upside the head of the Obama administration, U.S. foreign policy in general, the House of Saud. I mean, it's just what's going on in North Africa right now. Now, I want to go ahead and give you an opportunity, right, because we only have an hour, and after looking at this stuff, we could have gone three. So I want you to go ahead and talk about, you know, the deal that was made between the United States and whoever the heck behind them, pulling the strings there, and Saudi Arabia when as it pertains to United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Libya. Get us right into it, Pepe. Go ahead.
Well, Ernest, thanks very much for your lovely introduction. Well, I think it's a matter of making a few connections. Like today, Friday, finally, we could organize what was being suspected among BRIC countries in Western Europe, some parts of Asia, and across the Middle East. That there is a direct link between the Western attack, the Anglo-French-American attack on Libya, and the fact that the situation in Bahrain, which is quite similar, maybe not so many dead and wounded, but still is the same thing, including an invasion from Saudi Arabian forces, there is a direct link. And we got our confirmation from two different diplomats. We obtained this information independently, and they both said that, yes, a deal was struck between the House of Saud and the Obama administration. As long as the House of Saud made sure there was a vote for a no-fly zone within the Arab League, and that was the basis for UN Resolution 1973, that would be the okay for the U.S. to intervene in Libya. So we have been stressing this for weeks now in every progressive website, obviously not Western mainstream media, have been making some kind of connection. Now we have a direct connection from diplomats at the UN. Obviously, these diplomats, I wish I could reveal their names. And Ambassador Craig Murray, former UK ambassador in Uzbekistan, he's following the same story as well. In fact, I'm waiting to get an email from him to get his side of the investigation. And these sources are European and among the BRIC countries. It's very important to remember that UN Resolution 1973, these four BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, the top emerging powers of the future, plus Germany, they all abstained, which in the rigid diplomatic protocol of the UN means they don't agree with it. And in fact, one of the diplomats I talked to, he told me explicitly that we were raising the same objections together among them, the four BRIC countries. The resolution is too vague. It's open-ended. It's open to belligerence on both sides. It doesn't say expressly that it's a humanitarian mission, because there's a that famous paragraph that
any and all
the
means,
paragraph of the previous, exactly, relates to the paragraph of the previous resolution 1970, leaves it open the possibility of arming the rebels, which is exactly what's happening from the part of the Americas and the Brits and the French, who had been doing this for, I would say, at least 2 weeks now, because they've been in the Benghazi area for more than 2 weeks now. And on top of it, they were making the same objections that Bahrain, Yemen were similar cases to Libya. And the Germans were also saying the same thing. Plus, there's a very strong pacifist streak among some of the BRIC countries, and I'm talking specifically about Brazil and Germany as well. But now we have the proof from the inside that there was a trade-off, and all these five major powers, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and Germany, we cannot get involved into it, at least that this is our very diplomatic way of saying we don't agree with.
Okay, now I got to ask a question.
A member of French-American operation.
I got to ask a question on how this actually goes down in the United Nations. Because I choose not to care, you know, what the United Nations does. But, of course, you know, that doesn't mean they're not going to go out and cause mayhem. Now, the thing is that isn't there a capacity for a veto from the Security Council on these resolutions, or was it outside of that?
Yes, there is. But the thing is, it's a very complex geopolitical game.
Well, no, I understand. I just wondered, China did have the capacity to say no and stop
did.
The whole thing, right?
It did. But China foreign policy, Ernest, is extremely subtle. Don't underestimate the fact that they've been conducting foreign policy for 5,000 years now, at least. They were always thinking four or five moves ahead. They're thinking, okay, we won't antagonize the Europeans and the Americans this time, because later on, we can always tell them, look, when you needed us, we didn't say anything. Now, when we need you, you won't go against us. So they're always thinking moves ahead. And the Russians, there was a split inside the Russian leadership, which became public a few days ago between Putin and Medvedev. Medvedev was more inclined to accept the resolution. And Putin, remember when Putin said that this was a new crusade a few days ago? So there was a split right at the top. And Brazil and India were totally against it, and Germany reflected
how is it who
what European Union inside NATO.
What benefit do they have by not vetoing? I'm wondering what deal was struck with China and Russia and Germany. And I mean, this is a much wider deal, conspiracy, whatever the heck. I mean, who's running this planet? And you look at, you know, one of the things that you brought...
You pose a very pertinent question, Ernest, because we still don't know what kind of carrots the Americans, especially, because the Brits and the French, they are, you know, they are side actors in this whole drama. What kind of carrots the Americans offer especially to the Chinese and the Russians, we still don't know. It's going to take a while to find out.
You know, when we come back, we're going to be hitting the break here in less than a minute. And I wanted to make sure that we, there's so much I want to talk about, you know, the players on the international scale. But there was a deal that was kind of maneuvered amongst the Arab League also, you know, that you have.
Yes. Yes. So, you're right. And if I can put it in 20 seconds,
go.
This was a Saudi Arabia operation. Saudi Arabia maneuvered to get the Arab League no-fly vote with only 11 members of the 22-member Arab League. So I'll break it down for you. Six of them are the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council countries. This means Saudi Arabia and the Sheikh Thames and the Emirates. Syria and Algeria were against it. So there were three left that had to be, I would say, seduced by Saudi Arabia. That was very easy. So in the end, with 9 votes among 22, they passed a resolution supporting the no-fly zone. So basically, this was a GCC, Saudi Arabia-style operation, and the whole Arab League.
You know, when we come back, we're going to find out exactly how this all came about, who benefits, why, and what corporate logos behind it, if we even know. Is there a global corporate logo? Is it the business end of a gun, the United Nations doing something for? I don't know. We're going to find out.
You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, from beautiful Phoenix, Arizona, from Freedom's Phoenix Farm here on Declare Your Independence. I am truth, justice, and what used to be that American way. I don't know what the American way is from someone in Brazil, Pepe Escobar, writing for Asia Times as a foreign correspondent. I mean, you hear the American way, it's got to make you giggle a little bit, I imagine, doesn't it?
Well, look, Ernest, I lived in the U.S. I lived in California. I lived in Washington. I loved the West since I was a kid. So I know the West well, but I also know the rest of the world. And sometimes both worlds clash. And I'm being generous here.
You know, today we have a story on Freedom's Phoenix that is, it talks about the release of the documents from the Federal Reserve about who got the money. And they're finding out that a Libyan bank got a bunch of money from the Fed. And I'm going, I'm so shocked. So you have the Libyan bank, you know, is getting access to Americans' money. You have the all of the powers of the planet conspiring to allow people to be killed and to kill. But the thing is that I'm going, what is it that is driving this, even though that China and Russia and, you know, some of the others have veto power to stop this, but didn't, even though it's unpopular, but they want to have some competition that's going on in Africa between NATO and Western interests and China, certainly, you know, wants to get some goodies on the dark continent. So I'm going, there's something else going on that we don't know. And the control that the House of Saud has over the forces of freaking NATO that was there to defend against the Soviet Union, which is gone. So all of a sudden, NATO starts going into Afghanistan. Now they're going into North Africa. What is this, the military force of the UN? Because the next step is they're going to want a global tax. They're going to be able to have their own world army. And so I can see the end game 10, 15 years down the road or 5 months or whenever winds up coming. As we have the economic, you know, meltdown of the dollar and so on, anything's possible. And it seems that they're gearing themselves up to have an international force that is not led by anybody. It's just kind of this committee thing. And the end game is out of my grasp. And I need you to help me understand what the heck is going on, Pepe.
Ernest, I think you're absolutely right with one detail. This global force, the global cops, as I call them, already exists, and it's NATO. NATO started as an operation by the U.S. in the European continent against the commies, as we all know. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, NATO was absolutely irrelevant. So the Pentagon plus the NATO allies, they needed to find a new mission, and the mission is to become a global cop. So first chapter, 1999, the war against Serbia. They created a protectorate in Kosovo, which is run by a drug mafia, essentially. Chapter 2, Afghanistan. NATO is embroiled in an endless war in Afghanistan, which they have. If you talk to these commanders off the record, they'll tell you, we cannot win this thing. Nobody ever did. This is a bunch of warriors. They're being fighting amongst themselves and against foreign invaders for 2,500 years. There's no way you can impose Western might against a bunch of Pashtun warriors.
Well, that's their favorite kind of war. That's the kind of war they want. They don't want to win it. They want to fight it.
Exactly. They want a war like this because while they're fighting us from the West, they are not fighting among themselves. Remember what happened after the jihad in the 1980s in Afghanistan. As soon as the West left, they start fighting among themselves. They destroyed Kabul. They destroyed large country. And then it took an operation from Pakistan, the Taliban, which is a Pakistan creation, to sort of pacify the whole country by terror, in fact. I was there. I traveled extensively in Afghanistan. And this is the kind of society that was the ideal society according to the Wahhabi Saudis, the Pakistanis, and the United Arab Emirates, which were the only three countries in the world who were supporting the Taliban in the 1990s. So you have an idea of what the House of Saud would want. If they cannot impose a caliphate all over the world by the House of Saud itself or by Al-Qaeda, which is basically a Saudi creation with some Pakistani help, they want their sphere of influence to behave like them. This means it's a sort of a 7th century version of Islam. This is what they want for Bahrain, for instance. Bahrain is being ruled by a Sunni dynasty for 230 years, although the majority of the population is Shiite. And that's one of the reasons of the protest in Bahrain, but not the essential reason. The essential reason is people want a free and fair election, a decent parliament, less corruption, and that, you know, the beginning of the protest in Bahrain along these lines. But they were repressed so heavily that soon they start saying, we want the Al-Khalifa, the ruling dynasty, out of the picture. And obviously the House of Saud freaked out, and they needed American go-ahead for this disguised invasion of Bahrain. And this happened when they struck this deal. Okay, we smash the pro-democracy protests in Bahrain, and we give you the go-ahead to get a UN resolution, and you can do anything you want with Libya. First of all, because this is a detail that most people in America don't know, there is lethal bad blood between King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia and Gaddafi since 2002. I don't know, most people probably don't remember, there was a key meeting in the Arab League in 2002 in Cairo where Gaddafi, in public, told King Abdullah, which considers himself some sort of god on earth, that he was a traitor of the Arab nation, and he had sold out the Arab nation to the Americas because he was supporting the invasion of Iraq. So you can imagine what that means to an absolute ruler like King Abdullah Saudi Arabia. Now he's getting his vengeance, like, you know, 8 years later.
You know, that's another thing. Part of that, in your article, you have a reference to The vote was essentially a House of Saud-led operation with Arab League Secretary General, the National Council.
Under Musa, absolutely.
Now
yes, this is a very important subplot, Ernest, because Amir Musa, as the Secretary General of the Arab League, who actually enforced this this vote for the no-fly zone, he's a candidate to become the next Egyptian president.
Ah.
But in Washington, people look at Amir Musa and they say, we don't trust him completely. So what better way to polish your CV with the elites in Washington, both Democratic and Republican, than authorizing basically the U.S. to do anything it wants with Libya?
But what do you mean by that? I see you reference that, you know, keen to polish his CV. What does CV mean?
Because, you know, basically in Washington, Amir Musa was a former foreign minister as well. And especially Republicans at the time, they thought that he was, and even the Clinton people, they thought he was too independent. And he was not towing the line, the Mubarak line completely.
Well, you can see, we'll be right back here in just a little bit. I'm going to push the button on me, Pepe. But I tell you, you know, is this a good conversation, information we all need? You bet. You stay right there.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
I want to break free. I want to break free. I want to break free from your lies. You're so self-satisfied, I don't need you. I've got to break free.
Yeah, we got to break free here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and my special guest, Pepe Escobar. He's a foreign correspondent now for Asia Times, and man, does he got a lot of goodie that it's not uncommon knowledge. I mean, you know, if you go take a look, you go to antiwar.com, you get this. You look at, you know, on C section, page 47 of the, you know, New York Times, you might find a little bit about it. And they said, yeah, we mentioned that over here, kind of, but it's not consolidated like we have in the articles from Pepe. And you go to today's archive show. You go to Today with Pepe Escobar, and you all the links to his articles are there. You read them, and you're going to get up to speed. Now, yesterday, we had Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kwiatkowski that was in the Office of Special Plans there in the Pentagon. She told us, I mean, she confirmed a whole bunch of this stuff. She's going, yeah, we know they were lying us into all these wars. This is what they do. And she came out, and she went up against them. She fared okay. Now, Pepe, you've been going up against them a lot. I mean, when you start talking about guys that are CIA assets that want to be, you know, head of countries and working deals with, and they're coming out of exile to go in and want to play the games with and so on. This, I mean, I would imagine that Washington does not want this information coming out, would you think?
No, they don't, because this is a replica of, do you remember the Iraqi National Congress in 2002? Where virtually every week they were having a meeting in Washington or in London. All these Iraqi exiles were plotting to go back and organize the post-Saddam government. This is exactly what's happening now with these people who are basically returning from the U.S. Most of them are U.S. exiles, especially a guy called Khalifa Haftar, who defected from Gaddafi's forces in the late 80s. He lived in Virginia, in Vienna, like, what, 5 miles or so from Langley, for more than 20 years, and now he's back, and he's the military commander of the whole transitional council in Benghazi.
It is to laugh. Okay, now, Pepe, I want to make this one point. Now, I've been watching this, yes, and they talk about this guy coming out, but let me tell you what the impression that we get here by reading the articles. They call him a Gaddafi regime defector, but they don't tell you it wasn't last week. It was in the 80s. They're given the impression that he's defected just now.
And he defected a few days ago.
Right.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the problem. If you read the New York Times or the Washington Post, which sometimes their reporting is extraordinary, and sometimes their reporting is great for what they don't print, in fact. You always have to read between the lines in the New York Times and Washington Post. They would never spell out who are these people, what's their background, why they defected, when, and what are they up to nowadays. Like, you know, the head of the Transitional Council in Benghazi, which is a former justice minister of Gaddafi's, he did defect, I would say, a month ago, more or less. Same with the justice minister. But, okay, so now we have a mix of recent defectors who are part of the Gaddafi machine plus old exiles. And the people who actually started the revolution on the ground, the use of Cyrenaica, Eastern Libya, they have a movement called the February 17th Youth Movement. These are the guys, the young guys, you know, students, unemployed, you know, young intellectuals, lawyers, they started this. There was the element of tweet Facebook revolution in the beginning on the ground. Like, we were in touch with these people from the beginning. One of them was actually killed by a Gaddafi sniper 3 weeks ago. And now they're totally sidelined. And who took over? This bunch, you know, the exiles and the defectors from Gaddafi who are positioning themselves for the post-Gaddafi. This is something that happened in Iraq as well. There are a lot of people from the Baath Party who knew which way the wind was blowing, like in January, February 2003. They defected as well. And then they got, you know, handsome posts in the post-Saddam era. It's the same. It's always the same thing.
Wow. I'm when we had Hillary Clinton coming out and saying, it started with Tunisia. You had Tony Blair coming out and Hillary Clinton, and we got to help guide them to make sure that they got a government that we will allow them to have, and we're not going to bomb them again next week. Okay, so they wanted to control this from the beginning. So I could see what was coming. That's why we wanted it here. We had a project to just influence and educate the youth that make up 30% of the people are under 15 in the Middle East. I'm like, Of course they're internet savvy. Of course they're not, you know, we got 4% of the people are over 65. You can't get away from this demographic. And I'm going, you know, we're going to just let them know that they are allowed to own themselves philosophically. They don't have to just pick another pharaoh, okay? They don't have to be enslaved for millennia as they have been enslaved for past millennia. I mean, freedom marches on. Humanity trends forward. We got to just get off of this collectivist authoritarian empire, new world order, we own you, rule, whatever the heck it is. And we're going to try and drill down on this, you know, with help from people like you doing this information. But I noticed that Hillary comes out and they go, well, we need to speak with the opposition leaders. And they go, well, we don't want to talk to you. You know, these youth that you're referring to, I'm not even sure they really think that there is a leader. They're just, it's a movement. And when you don't have a head of a snake to chop off, oh, that's not good for the bad guys that want to rule you. So they have to create somebody.
You're totally right. They fabricated out of this wild bunch of exiles and recent defectors, they fabricated a leadership which does not reflect the mood of the young people who actually started all this. Why did they basically started a revolution in Eastern Libya? Because it's the poorest part of the country, although most of the oil is there. But the proceedings from the oil sales, they go to Tripoli, on the other side of the country. In Benghazi, you know, Brega, all those areas in the east, they are very, very poor. Then there's the element of the black Africans who go to Libya in search of jobs. Why do they do that? Because nowhere else in sub-Saharan Africa you can find a job if you are a black graduate from a local university. You go to Libya. At least you have a decent standard of living. It's the highest standard of living in Africa apart from South Africa. So it is a mecca for young people from Mali, from Niger, from Chad. I actually saw years ago, you know, those trucks that crossed the Sahara full of black Africans, destination Libya. They go like 3 or 4 days with a few bottles of water, and they endure whatever they have to endure just to find a mecca and to find a job. And now the regime itself uses these people, of course, but this is something that our UN fact-finding mission would find out, in fact. There's an enormous prejudice in these poorer areas of Libya against these black Africans. They bundle all these people up as Gaddafi mercenaries. They are not. They are normal, average Africans who are trying to find a better living without having to take a boat and go to Europe and flounder in the middle of the Mediterranean, you know. So there's so many aspects of the whole thing. It's not a clear-cut good guy against bad guy thing. It's not a John Wayne scenario. By all means, it's extremely complicated. And if you add to it a foreign Western intervention coordinated by two major colonial powers, Britain and France, and apart from the West, which is not exactly what popular in North and Africa.
Well, they've had this desire since Rome.
Quagmire, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I remember there was a senator in Rome. He goes, after anything he would say on the floor, he'd go, and Carthage must die. I mean, you know, so we're going back to Carthage again. I mean, this is, it's phenomenal to me. When we come back, we're going to talk about something you referenced, is that there's ideas to get a strategic base for both AFRICOM and NATO in Libya. What is it, rat patrol again? Oh, we'll talk about it.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
It's the same old story, same old song and dance, my friend. It's the same old story, same old story, same old
song and dance. I hear this. this over and over and over and over and over. It's the same old story. If you go back, I graduated high school in 79. What was going on then? Man, we got, you know, OPEC and oil prices, and oh my goodness, oil, you know, gasoline went above a dollar a gallon, and I had a 65 Chevelle Super Sport. I was paying attention. You know, and I'm going, wow. Then we had, oh, you got to register for the draft. Got to get in selective service. We might be going out and, you know, doing battle with the Arabs. You know, like, ooh, be afraid. Then you have Afghanistan getting invaded by the Soviet Union. So when we started going into Afghanistan, where we get most of our news, what was going on? From Pravda in Russia. Because they go, let me tell you what happens when you go in this valley. We already know. We're going to share it with you. And then you have just all of this. It's like you repeat the cycle. And as my children, I start having them in the mid-80s, and they're coming of age as we're going into the Middle East. Dad, you don't understand. Oh, the teacher said this. Oh, I'm going, really? Let's take a look at the headlines from 20 years ago. It's the same people. It's the same countries. It's the same motivations. You know, heck, it's even, you know, literally the same exact people, not positions, the same individuals. And now they're resurrecting them again, doing it all over. It's like you're in a freaking Twilight Zone episode. So now we're looking at, you know, the Gulf of Sidra is ships will come in, you know, to the west, at the top of Africa, you have Tripoli, to the east, you have Benghazi, and you're going, all right, what's the prize? What is it they really want? If you got NATO and AFRICOM, they want to have a base. They want to have a port. They want. Where's our United States big naval military presence on Africa? Don't got one? Let me tell you where we're going to get one. Ooh, we're going to do it in Libya. Why? Well, that makes, you know, as our guest Pepe Escobar, the foreign correspondent for Asia Times, said, he goes, that makes the Mediterranean NATO's big pond. That's our lake. Okay? Well, is that what they want? Of course that's what they want. What will they settle for? I don't know. Pepe, what do you think? Where's it going to stop? They're going to go there. They just want Benghazi and kind of get the eastern part, a bunch of the oil, or they want the whole thing?
Yeah, there are two possibilities, Ernest. One possibility is balkanization, like what happened with Serbia after the UN-US NATO bombing. We would have a sort of North Korea on the west side. That would be Tripoli, the Gaddafi clan in power. No oil or less than 20% of the oil reserves. Very angry and impoverished. And on the eastern side, we have, let's say, South Korea or an emirate like the United Arab Emirates transposed to Northern Africa, as an example. Lots of oil, 85% of the proven reserves, plus other reserves that can be exploited, especially by American and European companies and not Russian, Chinese, and Indian. Less people, of course, so you know, their standard of living can go much, much higher, dealing directly with the West. So you would be North Korea, South Korea. But now, the Anglo-French-American consortium and NATO, they want the whole thing because they can have a country with 6 million people with huge oil and gas reserves that can be exploited by their companies. They could marginalize China. Don't forget that Libya is one of China's key suppliers of oil in Northern Africa. It's not the biggest in Africa because Angola and Sudan sell more oil and gas to China. But Libya is very important as well.
They had to buy Russia off China somehow. How did they buy off China and Russia?
They won't. They will impose, they plan to impose their will, and it would be a fait accompli, like, you know, it's done, and the Chinese would have to swallow it.
Yeah, well, China will just sell their treasury bills. You know, they just sell the debt. I mean,
exactly, because you're right, they can retaliate big, big time. And that's why the Chinese are not saying anything at the moment.
They're going to kick our butt.
What the Chinese are expecting at this thing becomes a quagmire. I would say there is at least an 80% possibility that this is going to happen. And the Chinese are not making a single move. They're not even talking about it. They did talk yesterday. Sarkozy was in Beijing, and President Hu Jintao of China told him explicitly, look, this operation of yours is going nowhere. We are in favor of peace, and that's why we didn't vote for your resolution. And China wants peace and a dialogue and a ceasefire. So, you know, the West got the message directly from the lion's mouth yesterday. So this, he was saying, basically, if you screw up, we are going to screw up in the long run.
They can do the same thing that they did with Iran and sell them silkworm missiles to take out the entire freaking U.S. Navy out there. They say,
well,
you know, here,
you know,
they could have already given them to them for all we know. We are playing with fire here, and it is a mistake.
I agree. No, you're totally right. Okay, but the next detail in the big picture. Why Libya is so important for AFRICOM and NATO? So, okay, AFRICOM and NATO basically is the Pentagon. AFRICOM is the Pentagon's African command, which theoretically is in charge of the 53 African countries. But the headquarters is in Stuttgart because nobody among the 53 in Africa wanted AFRICOM based in Africa. And NATO, of course, is the Pentagon in Europe. Nothing gets done militarily in Europe without a U.S. okay. Nothing. NATO basically is the Pentagon arm in Europe. So they had a meeting, in a very important NATO meeting in Lisbon at the end of last year. And they approved what they call a strategic concept, which basically enshrines NATO as the global cop we were discussing in the beginning of your program. So a global police force. So their backyard is the Mediterranean. So obviously everybody in Brussels considers the Mediterranean a NATO lake. The problem is there are some countries who are not part of this whole arrangement, and Libya is key. There are only three countries who are not either aligned with NATO or aligned via, they have multiple partnerships with those weird bureaucratic names that nobody knows about, you know. So these are Libya, Syria, and Lebanon. Lebanon, there's a blockade against Lebanon since 2006. Syria, we just need to watch the news to see that Syria is breaking down fast. So that leaves the weak link, Libya. So they would rather have an African NATO or African NATO base in Libya, and then they buckle up the whole Mediterranean, and it becomes really a de facto NATO lake. That's why, in my opinion, they want the whole thing. They don't want an Emirates. They don't want Gaddafi on the other side.
To what end, though? I mean, the Chinese come in, they say, we'll show you how capitalism works. We'll negotiate a contract. Like you say, we've been doing this for thousands of years. So you negotiate a contract, find common interest. It's cheaper than sending in a freaking Navy. You know, so I'm going, I don't understand. There's something else. You got to help me out, man. What is it?
There's something else you're referring to. It's the Pentagon Cold War mentality. Everybody knows that Gates and Hillary were playing a good cop, bad cop game these past few days.
Yes.
Everybody knew that Pentagon, via NATO, was itching to get into this fight.
No, I can see. Let me comment on that. Gates goes, there won't be ground troops while I'm there. I'll resign. And he's playing, you know, the good cop. And Hillary, we got to go nuke him or whatever. And Gates, all of a sudden, he'll resign, and then he'll run for president. You think I'm kidding, man? He almost did last
time.
That's
a very good way of putting it.
You know, so I'm just, and he's going to be the peace president, as he was the war guy for Bush and Obama. It's just freaking Twilight Zone.
It is Twilight Zone, because, and the way the especially the U.S. corporate media does not explain how these games work, most public opinion have the impression that this is a high-level debate, what is our moral stature? We really care about civilians. We cannot interfere like crazy. And that's exactly what they do. They do interfere like crazy. Less than 48 hours after the passed the UN resolution. By the way, let me just say that Obama lost the war from Brazil, from a pacifist country, not from the U.S. soil. And the Brazilians, he's very popular here in Brazil. But after Brazilians looked at Obama as the warrior, his popularity now is at Bush level, to give an idea.
You know, I want to talk about Brazil. Pepe, are you willing to come back on the show?
Yes, of course. It's been a great pleasure.
You know, I really enjoyed our conversation. There's so much more that we found a big, big treasure in Pepe Escobar, foreign correspondent for Asia Times. I have so many more questions. I'm going to have them all written out, and then we're going to have you back very soon, and we're going to please my curiosity. Would you agree to that?
Yes, I do, Ernest.
Thank you very much. Uncovering the secrets and exposing the lies. That's what Readers of FreedomsPhoenix.com get every day. Readers of FreedomsPhoenix.com are constantly provided the information that detail the real news between the lines of propaganda about government policies and the true relationship we all have with coercive governments. Learn the true condition of our economy, innovations and technological breakthroughs in energy, health, computer science, and space travel. Learn the truth well before it's admitted to in the lamestream media, the media that is so last century. Corporate media has evolved into nothing more than distributors of government propaganda, but we now have a fantastic alternative. FreedomsPhoenix.com provides constant news updates on the issues that affect our lives in the most important ways. Our liberty and our property are under constant attack, and FreedomsPhoenix.com provides the understanding behind the propaganda while encouraging the participation of our readers. Join us at FreedomsPhoenix.com. That's Freedoms with an S, Phoenix.com. FreedomsPhoenix.com, where the revolution between the ears has already matured.